Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and brought to you by Super Target. Well, today it's global politics in the grocery store. Two takes on the fair trade coffee controversy. Reporter Anne-Marie Ruff takes us to coffee's birthplace, the highlands of Ethiopia, to hear how fair trade works for small coffee farmers there. Then coffee expert Kevin Knox reveals another side of fair trade in the American coffee industry. Sommelier turned wine maverick Joshua Wesson gets into sticky, delicious ports that don't come from Portugal. Then we talk with Moby, the man who makes music like no one else, has a restaurant like no one else. And as always, in the second half of the show, we are going to open the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. So let's get things started with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the road food column for Gourmet Magazine.
Lynn, one of the things we tend to forget when we're eating around New Orleans, which is such a great place to eat, is that New Orleans and Louisiana are actually part of the Deep South. And at a restaurant called Cafe Atchafalaya in the Garden District, we were reminded of that fact by the tremendous vegetables they serve there. They have a fabulous assortment of vegetables, probably a dozen different vegetables available every day, all cooked real down-home Southern style.
So you mean like in pot liquor with pork in them and that kind of thing?
Exactly. Fried corn fritters, crunchy green tomatoes, turnip greens, candied yams, field peas, cooked and candied carrots, black-eyed peas, cream spinach, etc., etc. In fact, when we ate there, the two of us each got a four-vegetable meal with cornbread on the side and wonderful iced tea on the side, and completely didn't have any entree, because who needs it when you're having vegetables this good?
Wait, now, what is this place like? Is it sort of, you know, what I think of as being a vegetarian restaurant?
Oh, my God.
Oh, God, no.
Oh, no.
No Birkenstocks here.
No. And, in fact, you can have fabulous andouille sausage and pork chops, et cetera, et cetera. And the whole ambiance is very, not, how can I put this, not vegetarian. It's a real kind of laid-back New Orleans cafe, a lot of room. People, I don't know if it's just my imagination or if it was just us that afternoon. People seem to occupy their tables and booths for a long, long time.
Well, why would you give it up when you had, I mean, we had fried, well, on another visit, we had fried chicken livers with red pepper jelly. Mm-hmm. We had
classic red beans and rice.
Oh, my God, absolutely great stuff. Pork chops, spicy soul food, meatloaf, bread pudding with cognac sauce. I mean, I could sit there all day, Michael. And I think we probably
sat there
half the day.
No, it's a very comfortable place. I remember the light kind of streaming in the late afternoon, and you're sipping your iced tea, and you're kind of going, oh, maybe we should have another order of that bread pudding with the cognac sauce. I don't know.
And the best thing is when you get there, the first thing that hits the table is a basket of just wonderful cornbread, plain and jalapeno cheese flavored, and a big pitcher of iced tea. And I mean, that really, that would be fine if the meal ended there, but thank God it doesn't.
What does it look like inside?
It's a rather plain looking restaurant. I think there are a series of rooms. Nothing fancy. This is not like a fancy linen tablecloth tuxedoed waiter's place.
It's very neighborhood feel.
Yeah, it's got a sort of a neighborhood cafe feel to it.
One of the things that you notice the minute you walk in is that every table is outfitted with at least a half a dozen different kinds of hot sauce. You know, vinegar-soaked peppers, spicy Tabasco, this, that, and the other thing, all, of course, to dress up your vegetables.
Which sound like they don't need much dressing up anyway.
No.
Oh, God. And, oh, don't forget to get the, did you mention the baked Creole tomato?
No.
Oh, that's
that
so
and
delicious.
The baked Vidalia onion. You know, it's one single onion that has been baked so that if you poke it, it just kind of falls into petals. Oh, it is so good.
Okay, you did it again. Thanks, you too.
Good evening, Lynn.
Goodbye, y'all.
Michael
Michael Stern are the authors of Road Food. Now, they left us with their recipe for stewed tomatoes, just in case you're in the mood for some of those Southern-style veggies after that piece. Now, you can get it on our website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, take a look at our newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen, and it's about easy meals for work nights. Each week, there's a new recipe, my notes on key ingredients, ideas for what to look for in the market, and best of all, it does not cost you a penny. You can find it on the website, splendidtable.org. Joshua Wesson is a wine expert who's convinced good wines can be had for not too much money. He checks out vintages all over the globe, and then he reports his discoveries here. Hey, Josh, welcome back.
Hi.
Josh, what can you tell me about port-style wines that are not made in Portugal?
Well, I'm glad that you asked the question in the way that you did, because it shows that you know that wines that are made like port, which means that they're fortified and they're sweet and insanely delicious to drink, if they don't come from this area around the town of Oporto in Portugal, then they can't technically be called a true port. In the same way that sparkling wines that don't come from this little area in northern France called Champagne can't technically be called Champagne. But there are wonderful sparkling wines that don't come from Champagne, and there are wonderful sweet fortified wines that are made like port that don't come from Portugal. And I've been nuts about fortified wine. I guess it's my Manischewitz heritage. You know, I can't help myself. I was warped at an early age.
Mm-hmm.
But I love port-style wines that come from places other than port almost as much as I love port itself, sometimes more, because there's no good reason why a winemaker who is applying the same techniques that they do in port to grapes that aren't grown there, why they can't make delicious wine. And they do. They do it in Australia. They do it in South Africa. They do it in the United States. And some of the most delicious fortified wine experiences I've ever had have come from New World ports.
So, you know, I always ask you the same question, but name names.
Well, I was in California not too long ago. And I went to a port tasting, and I was amazed at the range of ports that are available now. 20 years ago, when I got into the wine business, there weren't that many people making quality port. In fact, there was just a handful of producers. Now you need two hands and two toes and somebody else's hands to count them.
Mm-hmm.
But I went back to one of the original producers, one of the oldest producers of American port, Ficklin, and I tasted their non-vintage, their entry-level port. It's a tawny-style port, and it was absolutely delicious. It's about $10 for a half bottle, and it had all the nuttiness and the caramelliness and the mochiness that you find in a good tawny port from Portugal, but it was a little bit sweeter than a Portuguese port. And I had it with chocolate-covered almonds and then these bittersweet truffles dusted in chocolate. And it was just one of those a priori delicious, make-you-happy-all-day-long kind of matches. Really, really good stuff.
Well, you mentioned South Africa. What about ports from there?
Well, you know, there's been a very long and very consistent winemaking tradition in South Africa of producing fortified wines. They don't use the same Portuguese-style grapes that a lot of California producers have favored. They tend to use Shiraz, Pinotage, sometimes Cabernet Sauvignon. But the wines that I've tasted have been exceptionally good. And in fact, they're the opposite of the California wines. They're a little bit less sweet, generally, than the Portuguese-style ports. And one of the largest producers of South African port is KWV. Probably the most well-known label in South Africa, and it's a massive industrial producer of wine, but they actually devote a little bit more care to their port-style wines than they do to some of their dry cork-finished wines. And their entry-level Ruby port, which sells for about $10 for a full bottle, is one of those wines that, even though it may be a little bit rough around the edges, is incredibly good with blue cheese and really good with a sweet chocolate desserts that aren't too sweet. If it's bittersweet, if it's edging towards the dry side of sweet in the chocolate world, these ports are absolutely for you. And because they're $10 a bottle, you can afford to drink them in the morning, in the afternoon, anytime you want. Put them in milk as a fortifier, like Bosco for adults.
This is not a bad idea. You mentioned Australia. A lot of port style wines coming out of there, aren't there?
Yeah, you know, they love their stickies down in Australia. They call anything that will put your lips together and keep them together a sticky, and that can be a late harvest white wine made from Semillon or Sauvignon. But they've had a fondness for port and fortified wines, red sticky wines, that go back almost 300 years. And in a way, the ports that come out of Australia have really contributed to the success of their wine industry. And a lot of their top producers have been making port-style wines for a very long time. And they tend to use Shiraz, the most widely planted red grape in Australia. And unlike California and unlike South Africa, these wines come in every possible style you could imagine. I mean, I think that there's probably as big a range of port-style wines in Australia as you might find even in Portugal. And I stumbled across a little producer, actually not so little, but they have a tawny port, and the producer's name is Buller, B-U-L-L-E-R. It's from the Victoria region of Australia. And this wine, for about $12 a bottle, will make any true port lover extremely happy. It has that toasty mocha chocolate jamocha almond fudge, a little bit of raisin and nutmeg and cinnamon and allspice, and throw in some prunes to keep you regular, and I think that it's just, you know, a fantastic drink.
This is just what we need for the midwinter blahs.
Attention, Floridians.
Thanks, Josh.
You're in a nursing home. Drink port.
You take care.
My pleasure.
Joshua Wesson is creator of Bestsellers Wine Shops. Now, you can find his non-port ports on the website, splendidtable.org. You know, my way of taking port, it's a little trick and it's fun. You take dried figs, cut them in quarters, and you press into each quarter a whole toasted almond. And you crunch on that, and you've got the figs that are melting kind of in your mouth, and they're grainy, and they're like a sauce, and you sip that port. That's living. Well, coming up, global politics in the supermarket, the fair trade coffee controversy, and open lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget. SuperTarget believes in putting the fun back into food. It's a grocery store inside Target. To find a store near you, you can visit them online at target.com/SuperTarget. Food, commerce, and politics have been uneasy partners since the first humans fought over monopolizing the local mastodon herd. Controlling the supply so that you can buy cheap and sell high makes sense until you look at who's affected by that control. Coffee is one of the commodities that's controlled by this kind of system. Now, we're going to start out by taking a look at the farmer's side of the equation. Reporter Anne Marie Ruff takes us to the birthplace of coffee, the highlands of Ethiopia.
Okay, let us start capping now.
I'm in the Ethiopian capital of Addis Ababa, talking with Yismashwe Seyum, who knows his coffee. He makes his living as a coffee taster. In the trade, he's called a cupper, and he's trying to show me how to cup coffee.
This is the way.
So here's my big soup spoon. Which one should I start with? This
okay.
one?
Okay. Very quickly. You sip it with air. Yes. Test it. And just put it in the spitzer. Okay.
That was very graceful, wasn't it?
Okay, I may not be the best cupper, but the Sidamo and Yirgacheffe varieties of coffee that we're tasting are some of the best in the world. That's not surprising, as coffee was born here in Ethiopia. The story goes that more than 1,000 years ago, a shepherd noticed that his sheep became unusually energetic when they ate wild coffee berries. So the shepherd started eating the berries too. To hear how coffee went from wild berries to the world's most widely traded agricultural commodity, I head over to Ethiopia's Institute of Biodiversity to talk with the director, Abebe Demesi.
Well, if you allow me, I would like to tell you the story of coffee. Coffee originated here in Ethiopia, and it was taken out from here way back from Ethiopia to Yemen. It was taken from there to Java, which was then a colony, the Dutch colony, and taken away from Java to, I reckon, to Netherlands and then to France. It is from there that was taken to the New World, to South America, and I think it is the Portuguese which brought it back to Western Africa. And from there, some of the coffee materials were brought over to as far as Eastern Africa.
Coffee may have spread all over the world, but in terms of coffee varieties, this part of the world remains the richest. Abebe's Institute is home to the world's most diverse collection of coffee trees. There are more than 2,000 different varieties of coffee, all with different genes. In the event of a major coffee disease, scientists will come here, searching out genes to resist those diseases. So Ethiopia is the key to coffee's history, and it will likely be the key to coffee's future. And for a look at coffee's present, I take a drive to the village of Choche in the mountains of southwest Ethiopia. Here, I meet Bekele Jirata, an agriculture expert.
But this is all this forest you see in the Choche area, the origin of coffee.
Farmers here have been growing coffee for more than a millennium, and they sing about their traditions with great pride. A trip here wouldn't be complete without tasting the local brew, and Choche's farmers are eager to share their produce with guests. The coffee ceremony is one of Ethiopia's most conspicuous traditions. First, green coffee beans are roasted by hand, then ground in a mortar. The grounds are boiled over a fire in a black coffee pot with a long spout. The coffee is wonderful, a bit spicy and fragrant, but there's a bittersweet quality to drinking coffee in Choche, as there's so much discussion about how little farmers have been earning for their coffee berries, about 3 cents a pound. At this price, farmers are no longer able to buy clothes for their families or send their children to school. Zarihun Alamayu organizes coffee farmers into cooperatives so they have more influence in the market.
And we claim that God gave us coffee, and we gave it to the world. And for this gift, it seems that the world is not paying us.
He explains that, in fact, the world isn't paying coffee farmers in other countries either. The current crisis in the coffee market is due mostly to a glut of coffee beans. That has driven prices down to a 30-year low. Supply used to be controlled by something called the International Coffee Organization. The ICO enforced quotas on coffee production, much like OPEC regulates the oil industry. But when the U.S. pulled out of the ICO in 1989, the coffee market became a free-for-all. Countries like Brazil and Vietnam increased their production, flooding the market with lower-quality Robusta beans. That has spelled bad news for everyone. Ethiopian farmers are growing so desperate, some of them are getting out of coffee altogether. Even Ethiopia's Prime Minister, Meles Zenawi, is upset about the loss of coffee trees.
That some of the farmers are uprooting their coffee trees and replacing them with cut trees. It's a mild narcotic. It's widely consumed in the Horn of Africa and to some extent in Yemen. The social implications of such a shift are very serious.
Khat is sold as a legal drug in East Africa and illegally in the U.S. and U.K., where it can fetch $180 a pound. In order to grow khat, which likes full sun, farmers have to cut down the forests that protect their coffee bushes. In my search for a good cup of coffee, I have found a bitter brew of poverty, drugs, and deforestation, not to mention a decreasing supply of high-quality coffee. But coffee addicts shouldn't despair. We may not be able to solve the big market picture and reimpose quotas or decrease production, but we are part of the mix. Some market observers say the best thing coffee drinkers can do is treat ourselves to the best coffee in the world. By doing that, we support shade-grown coffee and the farmers who grow the best Arabica beans. I say farewell to Ethiopia and head back to the U.S. to search out high-quality Ethiopian beans. It turns out to be an easy quest. In Minneapolis, I find T.J. Samanchin at Peace Coffee roasting up Ethiopian beans. He buys his beans on a fair trade basis, directly from farmers' cooperatives. That cuts out middlemen and gives farmers 2 to 3 times the market price. TJ says it's good business.
Peace Coffee is about 5 years old, and we've doubled sales for the past 3 years. So the people of the Upper Midwest and Minnesota have been very receptive to our message and to our product. One, that it's socially responsible, being fair trade. Two, that it's environmentally responsible. All of our coffee is organic and shade grown, and it's amongst the best coffee in the world.
TJ says Peace Coffee is just one of a growing number of small roasters selling fair trade coffee. That's not only a boon for coffee drinkers, it also helps Ethiopian farmers to stay on their farms, to continue tending their coffee bushes, maintaining the forests, and sending their children to school. That makes for a pretty rich brew, not to mention a satisfying cup of coffee. For The Splendid Table, this is Anne-Marie Ruff, Choche, Ethiopia.
Okay, so it sounds like fair trade coffee gets more profits to coffee farmers in developing countries. Let's look at fair trade from another point of view, that of coffee expert and coffee buyer Kevin Knox. As a coffee buyer for Allegro Coffees and Starbucks, Kevin has traveled to nearly every coffee-producing area of the world. He is co-author of Coffee Basics, A Quick and Easy Guide. Hey, Kevin, welcome.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Kevin, I want to talk to you today about fair trade coffee. What exactly is it?
Well, I think that the first thing is that the very phrase itself, fair trade, is it's so compelling, and it has the great advantage in this era of limited attention spans of fitting on a bumper sticker or fitting on a bin in a grocery store and making you feel good about your purchase. Fair trade is really something that originated in Europe, where there has been historically a lot more sensitivity to the plight of farmers. And it was a movement that originated particularly in Germany and Holland, with the idea of guaranteeing farmers, particularly in third world countries, a price for their product that was above the cost of production and would guarantee a reasonable profit. It's a movement that has been very well established in Western Europe and even in Canada, and it's made its way to the U.S. In the last few years. So that's the simple answer to
All
fair
right.
trade.
Now, I gather there's more to this.
Mm-hmm.
You sound a little skeptical when you say that.
Well, actually, I mean, I think the motivation behind it is compassionate, and it's rooted in a desire to see a more just economic situation. It's a certification system, for one thing, which involves setting minimum prices for various commodities and making sure that a certain percentage of proceeds for products gets to farmers in selected third world countries. On the face of it, it seems like a very good idea, and there's no question the movement has done a lot of good. And it is something that is not well understood, I think, here in the U.S. The market in the U.S. for fair trade products is very different than that in Europe.
How is it different?
Well, fair trade coffee in Europe was an effort simply to get above market prices for commercial grade or commodity grade coffee. And so when you go into the supermarkets in Europe, you'll see coffee that's of the quality of a Folgers or other commercial supermarket brand, but it sells for a 30% premium, and the consumer knows that the farmer who grew the coffee is getting a fair price for it. And that's a very well-established market. So it's commercial coffee with a conscience. What happened when that movement came over to here to the U.S. is that the U.S. is a much bigger market, of course, than any of the European countries. And the people in the fair trade movement said, well, we're not going to get an audience going to the gigantic institutional roasters, the Folgers and Taster's Choice of this world. Where are there going to be consumers that are sympathetic to our social agenda? And they said, well, they're going to be going to Starbucks, and they're going to be buying from Pete's. They're going to be the gourmet coffee people, and so we're going to position these fair trade coffees as a specialty type of product that deserves a specialty coffee price, even though there are no quality standards for fair trade coffee, and most of it is produced on marginal quality farms at low elevations. And when you add that situation, that fact, to the fact that currently we have a world that is grossly oversupplied with coffee, supply greatly exceeds demand, there are some who feel that paying an artificially high price for coffee just encourages more overproduction of a product which we are currently in crisis because of an oversupply of. So that's one of the problems with fair trade, is it's an aid program, not a trade program. It's a subsidy program that affects a very, very small number of farmers. And that's why there have been serious questions, particularly in the specialty coffee side of things, about whether this is really a sustainable way to market coffee.
Well, what would be the alternative?
Well, there are a lot of alternatives. The true specialty part of the market is very small. It's really less than 5% of the U.S. market when you look at people that are buying top quality, defect-free, high-altitude coffees. And historically, those coffees have commanded a very high price based on their intrinsic merits. There's competition between the Japanese, the Germans, the top U.S. roasters, of course, the legendary Ely Cafe in Italy. These roasters tend to vie for these top quality coffees. And so there's been a lot of people that have said, well, the real answer is to build more of a consumer market for high-quality coffees, which, like any high-quality foodstuff, command a high price based on their intrinsic merits. That's been slow going, though, and particularly because what's been growing in coffee in the last 20 years has been these rather notorious high-value added products, the instant cappuccinos, the international coffees, these things where the quality of the coffee used in the product doesn't make much difference. And so we're in a very difficult crisis with coffee, and there's a strong argument to be made that fair trade, which guarantees farmers a minimum FOB price of $1.26, or any other mechanism that keeps somebody from literally starving to death in this current crisis, mm-hmm. Ought to be supported. I think the real issue is that there's a lot of trading fairly that goes on for high-quality coffees that isn't part of the certification system. One of the biggest things is that in order for a coffee to be called fair trade, it has to be produced by a co-op, a small co-op. And that means that independent small farmers, family-run farms, cannot be members. So automatically you're excluding almost all of the world's high-quality coffees, which is produced not by cooperatives, but by family-run farms. And so roasters, including some of the ones I just mentioned, who've been buying these top-quality coffees for 20, 30, 40 years, mm-hmm. cannot call their coffee those coffees fair trade, even though they're trading fairly for them and paying a high price, because they're not part of this aid program, the certification system.
Are you saying then that to buy fair trade coffee and be able to market it,
you are always buying a lower grade coffee that normally a premium coffee company would not sell?
Not always, but most of the time, because the farmers who sign up to be part of these programs are farmers whose, again, whose product on its intrinsic merits could never earn these above market prices. They're people that are usually very small, poor farmers, often who, at lower elevations, consigned to some of the less favorable land. Obviously, people that already have been growing coffee in optimum circumstances and have a reputation, they don't need a handout because they're already earning a high price based on the intrinsic merits of the product. So overall, the quality of the fair trade coffees tends to run from defective to mediocre, unfortunately.
So, Kevin, as consumers, what should we do?
Well, I think that, as with any food product, what we should do is make every effort as consumers to support the small, the handmade, the personal, and the local, wherever we can. Ideally, if you have a local roaster in your market who is committed to both quality and social justice, as most small roasters that I've run into are, to ask them and find out how much they know about where their coffee comes from. You can't take much as one would like to with the amount of pressure, you can't take a bumper sticker size slogan, whether it's shade grown or fair trade or even certified organic, and say, well, that's the end of it. So I think it's just a matter of asking questions and inquiring rather than getting hung up on labels and politics. We do have, I must say, you know, particularly in the specialty or smaller side of the business, there's an enormous level of commitment to these values across the board. What you should absolutely not do if you care about sustainability and about a reasonable return for farmers is to continue to buy the value 3-pound can in the supermarket, because then you are supporting the very trade and farming practices that have brought the industry into a state of crisis.
Kevin, thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Coffee buyer Kevin Knox is author of Coffee Basics, A Quick and Easy Guide. The political beast in me wants to urge you to buy the best beans, of course. So I'm posting a recipe as bait. Now, this is a dessert. It's easy to make, and it just tastes great. It's espresso ricotta cream with espresso chocolate sauce. And for contrast, try serving it with a cup of Ethiopian Sidamo coffee. Now, you're going to find it on the website, splendidtable.org. Okay, guys, it's time for the weekly trivia challenge. And I'm not really ready to leave coffee behind. Now, if you remember, early on in the report from Ethiopia, you heard reporter Anne-Marie Ruff mention cupping or tasting coffees the way the experts do. So here's our trivia question. Essentially, how do experts cup a cup of coffee? Now, we're going to have that answer in a moment. We're going to be talking with techno-musician Moby, and we'll be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget. It's Target, now available in food. At SuperTarget, you can find the foods and ingredients for your favorite recipes, plus the things you need to serve it up, all in one stop.
Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. The number is 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, how do professional coffee tasters cup a cup of coffee? Well, this is a lesson in how to get every single drop of pleasure out of coffee. The experts first fresh grind the beans, and then they put 2 tablespoons of coffee in a 6-ounce cup. They pour filtered water that's just off the boil over the coffee, and it brews for a few minutes. Now, by the way, I've got to give credit where credit is due. All of this information comes from Kevin Knox's book, Coffee Basics. Now, the official tasting really begins with tasters doing what's called breaking the crust. That is, they take a soup spoon and they break the crown-like crust of the coffee grounds that's formed on the surface of the liquid. Now, as they do this, they bring their noses just over the liquid to get the full impact of the coffee's aromas. Now, next, they allow about 3 to 5 minutes for the coffee to cool a bit and for the grounds to settle. Then they take a hearty slurp from the spoon. Now, the slurping aerates the coffee, but most important, it coats the entire mouth with the liquid. And this activates every single possible taste sensation. Then they spit out the coffee. Now, Kevin explains cupping involves 2 tastes. One when the coffee is hot, and that first taste tells you the body of the coffee or the weight of it. But the second taste is the one that's crucial. It's done when the coffee is tepid. And this is the taste, still slurping, still aerating, still filling your mouth with the coffee. This is the taste that reveals all the subtleties, the acidity, the aromas, the flavors of the individual beans. We do have a warning. Do not attempt this at home with Folgers. We're opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's see. Who have we got waiting? We've got Katie on the line. Hey, Katie, what do you want to talk about?
I have a question about cooking with milk and cream and cheese. I don't always use recipes in the kitchen. And a few weeks ago, I made a little side dish of Alfredo that came out pretty good with olive oil and 2% and Romano cheese. And I decided a few days later to turn it into the main course. And so I just kind of tripled my ingredients. And when I threw my Romano in there, it turned into these malignant balls of goo. And I was confounded because I thought the only way you can ruin a cream or a cheese sauce is by boiling it. And I never boil.
Well, the thing is that if you expose cheese to heat that's too high, uh-huh, or if you have it exposed to heat for too long, it's going to separate. And what was happening to the Romano is probably the pan was too hot.
Okay.
Were you stirring it into the oil?
Yeah.
Okay, that's the problem.
No, you know what I did is I did oil, milk, then Romano.
I see. It was probably too hot.
Okay.
Yeah, so if it's lower. By the way, can I tell you a trick?
Yeah.
The old way of making Alfredo?
Yeah.
And it's so easy. Melt a stick of butter. This is for about a pound of pasta, all right? And this is the old sexy Roman way.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, boil your pound of pasta, usually fettuccine, but whatever you like. Meanwhile, in a skillet, melt a stick of butter.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Drain the pasta.
Mm-hmm.
Toss it in the skillet, medium heat, all right?
Okay.
Add 1/4 to 1 cup of cream, depending on how exciting, how much fat you like.
Uh-huh.
All right. Just keep tossing. Medium heat. All right. Salt, pepper, and then big handfuls of Parmigiano-Reggiano cheese.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it's heaven.
Because the sauce is actually made on the pasta. Now, certain people I know, like me, have reduced down the amount of butter to half the amount and used about 1/4 cup of cream and then the Parmigiano, and you still get a great one. So that's another way to try it.
Do you think it's impossible to make a nice Alfredo with just olive oil and like 2% milk?
Well,
I mean, this is for everyday cooking where, I don't want to do the...
Yeah, I understand. No. You can. But I would say don't try to make the sauce separately. Just toss the pasta with it.
Toss it all together.
Yeah, because Alfredo is a coating for a pasta. So mm-hmm. you could do olive oil and you could do, you know, I'd skip the milk. I would do olive oil and cheese.
Really?
And don't try to make it creamy. You see?
Okay.
Yeah, I do olive oil and cheese. That's a classic. It's delicious. You can throw some fresh herbs in there.
Yeah.
You know, black pepper. It's sensational.
Good.
Okay?
All right. Thank you so much, Lynn.
You take care.
You too.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Reach us at 800-537-5252. We'll see. Now, who's up? Ah, Maria has been waiting patiently. Maria, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I love your show.
Thank you.
I don't cook a whole lot, but I still love your show.
You know, that's a great compliment. Thank you.
I hope someday to cook more. Well, one of the things I like to make when I do cook things for special occasions, I have a recipe for basil shrimp pasta.
Mm, sounds good.
And part of the reason I don't make it is it calls for, you have to devein and peel the shrimp, uncooked shrimp, of course. And I think that it just takes forever. It takes forever to devein shrimp.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was wondering about that. Like, why? I'm, you know, is it mostly taste or safety, health? Why do we devein? What are your suggestions for doing it?
This is a good question. Because some cookbook authors and writers say, don't bother. The reason you devein shrimp is that that vein is evidently part of the digestive system. And some people don't care to have that.
That's what I was told.
If it's a huge shrimp, really big shrimp,
right?
The vein can be gritty. But if, and by the way, some people on smaller shrimp, you know, figure the heck with the deveining. And I have to confess, when I'm doing a lot of shrimp, I don't bother unless they're really big.
Really?
But there is a gadget out there that's really great because it deveins and it removes the shell at the same time.
Okay.
And most fish stores sell it, and you'll find it in every kitchen shop, you know, known to man. It's this plastic thing. It costs maybe $4 or $5. I can't quite explain it, except it looks like a long plastic, almost a knitting needle, and it has sort of a sharp end. And the idea is that you put it on, you slip it under the shell at the head end of the shrimp. In so many words,
okay.
Opposite the tail, and you just slip it under that shell all the way down to the tail, and then you lift. And what you're doing is you're removing the vein and you're removing the shell at the same time.
Oh, good.
Neatest little thing. And, you know, I always have a couple of them. I have them in drawers all over the kitchen because I always forget where I put them. And they're cheap enough and they're plastic. You know, they go with you anywhere.
Cool.
Yeah, I always have.
I think it's necessary for the real small.
No, for the small ones and the medium ones.
Medium size, what about that?
I wouldn't bother. I really wouldn't. Unless, you know,
I like that answer.
Some people have concerns and they like to remove it. It's purely a matter of choice.
Which, I have one last question.
Sure.
Why is it cheaper to buy shrimp peeled and deveined? Is that because it spoils before, if it doesn't cook it?
You know what? I think, I don't know why, but you mean already peeled and deveined?
Yeah.
It doesn't make sense to me either, but I really like to get my seafood that in a shape that it's the least tampered with.
Right.
And I know it's absolutely fresh. And, you know, shrimp is always frozen.
Right.
If someone's selling you fresh shrimp and you live on the Gulf Coast, you can believe it. If someone is selling you fresh shrimp in Maine,
live in Oklahoma.
not a chance of a snowball in hell of finding, you know, fresh shrimp. That's safe. So, you know, usually it is frozen and then defrosted in the market for sale. But I don't know the answer to that. Because, you know, but I usually buy it with the shell on. And by the way, save the shells, throw them in the freezer. They make the best broth in the world.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. All garlic, right. Shells, white wine, water. Simmer 30 minutes. You have soup. Ooh.
Would never think of that.
Try it.
Well, thank you so much.
You take care.
All right.
Bye-bye. Bye. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Okay, let's see who is next. We've got Jennifer calling. Jennifer, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hi. Well, I wanted to talk about grass-fed lamb. I work on Martha's Vineyard on an organic teaching farm.
Oh.
And we raise grass-fed lamb. And I hear that you have to cook it differently than regular lamb. Know anything?
Well, have you tasted it? And have you already tried to cook it?
Yeah, I actually cooked a leg
for
Christmas dinner, and it was fabulous.
See,
the best lamb I've ever eaten.
You know, it can be wonderful. I mean, it all depends, obviously, what the animal is eating. But one of the things that occurs to me, if it's on Martha's Vineyard, which is an island, mm-hmm. It may be like there's a salt marsh lamb that is very famous in France, and people claim that the meat has fabulous flavor because the salt breezes coming through the grass. Actually, the lamb is salted from the inside out, aside from all the other factors of organic and everything else. Mm-hmm. This is just supposition on my part. Is there a difference? I think there has to be. If you have an animal live its last weeks of its life eating corn and grain, I think it develops more fat.
It does, yeah.
And I think grass-fed is probably less fatty, but would have a wonderful flavor.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, aside from the whole organic issue and it being perhaps better for us and that kind of thing, I think you can get a truer taste of where the animal has come from. And as far as cooking it differently, I don't know that you would cook it very differently. Lamb is always young meat. I think when you're dealing with a really thick piece of lamb, like a leg, I prefer to cook it slowly, like 325, maybe 350.
Yeah, that's how I cooked this one, and it was great. I was just wondering if there's a way to make it better.
Oh, I think that comes down to things like flavoring and that kind of thing, because you're already starting out with something that's pretty extraordinary.
Right.
You know, if you're doing a smaller piece, like the rib, or, you know, what they call the rack of the lamb, that you can do very fast, because if you do it at 450 or that kind of thing, it will just start to cook on the outside, and then if you pull it out of the oven or just let it sit, it'll cook right through to the center and be nice and rosy. But as far as making it better, one of the things I love to do with lamb is I mix orange zest and garlic and some wine and a little olive oil.
Oh.
Yeah, and an herb, and usually something soft like basil, you know, something very, very, a blending herb, an herb that has a lot of aroma and aromatic to it but isn't strong. And I make slits in the lamb, and I just tuck that into the slits and stick it in the fridge overnight and then roast it the next day.
Mm, wow, that sounds great.
Yeah, I mean, it's one, but I just think it's wonderful. This teaching farm, are you working with children?
Yeah, we work with all the island school systems. We have a summer program and an after-school program and in-school programs.
So are the kids actually coming to work on the farm and
they
work with the animals?
Yep, they're not our primary labor force, of course, but they come and do everything we do side by side with us.
This is great. Keep up the great work. Sounds like a neat job.
Yeah, it is great.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.
You can call us at 800-537-5252. There's a good thing to remember here. If the meat is big and thick, cook it slower. If the meat is tiny and tender, you can cook it faster. Well, some news. A celebrity restaurant has opened in New York City that's pretty unexpected. No, it's not the super glitz of the Britney Spears disaster. In fact, it's just the opposite. There's no glitz at all. The restaurant is called Teeny, and its owner is the cerebral techno musician Moby. We have him on the phone. Hey, Moby, thanks for joining us.
Hi.
Moby, you know, you're not the kind of performer that I think of as having a celebrity restaurant. So how did you get into having a place to eat?
Well, I wouldn't really call Teeny a celebrity restaurant. In fact, one of the only rules we have at Teeny is that they're never allowed to play my music.
You're kidding.
yeah, that was good. I opened it with my ex-girlfriend, Kelly. We had this idea about a year ago. We were talking, and we realized we both wanted to own a sort of, you know, small vegetarian restaurant slash cafe. And we were both kind of obsessed with tea, because, I mean, the fascinating thing about tea is that, you know, I mean, there's such a long tradition, and the way it's grown and treated and processed, it's all
mm-hmm.
really fascinating. So the idea was to open, like, a really nice, cute vegetarian restaurant that focused on tea.
So how many kinds of tea do you have?
At present, we have 97.
Oh, brother.
But we're always adding more.
And is that how the name came about, Teeny?
Well, it's supposed to be sort of a double entendre or a pun, because on one hand it's called Teeny because it's so small.
Yeah.
I mean, really, you know, it really is teeny. You know, when we have 25 people in there, we're rammed to the gills. And it's also Teeny. It's spelled T-E-A-N-Y because we sell a lot of tea and we're in New York. So
Tea New York.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Now, where is it located?
It's on 90 Rivington Street, which is in the Lower East Side. Which, one of the reasons that Kelly, my ex-girlfriend, and I decided to put it there was because we found this really, really wonderful space with, you know, it faces south with big windows and has a little outdoor space in front. But it's also an easy walk from both of our apartments.
Oh, well, there's a good restaurant. This is why location is so important, right?
Location, especially when the people who own it can get there within 5 minutes by walking. Yeah.
You know, if I remember, isn't this a neighborhood with a lot of the old-style classic Jewish delis?
Yeah, I mean, the Lower East Side is interesting. It's been sort of a crucible for immigration, you know, for really the last 150 years. And the neighborhood we're in traditionally was the, you know, where a lot of the Jewish settlers had immigrated to. And so you have, you know, we're right across the street from a Romanian synagogue. And there are synagogues all over the place and Jewish delis. But I guess in the last 30 or 40 years, the neighborhood's also been heavily populated by Latinos and Chinese immigrants.
So do any of the locals come to Tini?
They do. I mean, the Lower East Side, the other reason we wanted to have the restaurant there is because it's just, by my estimation, the most fascinating part of Manhattan. Because you have, you know, punk rockers and artists and, you know, old Jewish immigrants and Chinese families and Latino kids on bikes and little trendy boutiques. I mean, it's just this really strange melting pot of culture. And everybody comes into Tini.
It sounds great. Are you really enjoying having this?
Oh, I love it. I mean, I'm 37 years old and I don't have children yet. And so Tini is kind of like my surrogate child, you know. And I go in there every day, and it's just such a nice place because it's really bright and it's really sunny. And, you know, I hope I don't sound like I'm shamelessly self-promoting, but I love it.
No, it sounds like you love it a lot. You're going to miss it when you're on tour, aren't you?
Yeah, it's strange. When I go on tour, I miss my friends to some extent, and I miss my home to an extent. But what I really miss is just being able to hang out in Tini.
Well, maybe we'll see you there one day.
Oh, not to give away my secrets, but I'm there pretty much every day, at least a couple times a day.
Well, you realize now that there are about 2 million people who now know that. Hey, thanks so much for talking with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
You take care. Moby's latest album is 18. Now, you can find information on his restaurant, Tini, on the website, splendidtable.org. Well, that's the show for this week, everybody. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us day or night, 800-537-5252. And until next week, let me leave you with this quote from Dolly Parton. She said, "The way I see it, if you want a rainbow, you got to put up with the rain." The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget. Everything you heard here and so much more can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. Be sure to check out the Splendid Table store while you're there. All the proceeds go to support this very program. And don't miss out on our free newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen, and we hope it helps make your weeknight cooking a little easier. Register for it online, splendidtable.org. Our program is produced by Sally Swift with help from Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed nationwide by Public Radio International. Have a great week. And join us next time. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
PRI, Public Radio International.